Turn things over to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Spotlight on Women's Health Cyber Seminar Series. I'm Dr. Jessica Friedman. I'm an epidemiologist and a co-investigator with the Women's Health Research Network Consortium. I'm thrilled to introduce our speakers today, who will present her research on the understanding and treating urinary incontinence in women veterans. Today's summer seminar will be presented by Dr. Elaine Markland. Dr. Markland is a professor of medicine in the Division of Gerontology, Geriatrics, and Palliative Care, and the holder of the Parish Professorship in Geriatric Medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, in Birmingham, Alabama. She's also a nationally recognized clinician researcher at the Birmingham VA Healthcare System and the director of the Birmingham Atlanta Geriatric Research Education and Clinics Center, or GREC. She's the principal investigator on the NIH-funded multi-center consortium on prevention of lower urinary tract symptoms in women, or the PLUS network, and the principal investigator on other NIH, AHRQ, and VA-funded clinical trials. Dr. Markland is joined today by Dr. Chelsea Morgan, director of comprehensive health at the VA Office of Women's Health. Dr. Morgan is a family medicine physician based in Washington, D.C. Her role at the VA, she's the Women's Health Staffing and Innovations Enhancement Initiative Leader, WISE Lead, which has funded over $275 million in national women's health staffing and equipment over its four-year tenure. She's also a subject matter expert on a variety of topics within women's health, such as COVID-19 in women, sexual health, HIV prevention, and health equity. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Markland.
Thank you so much, Dr. Friedman and Dr. Morgan, for being here with us today. It is my distinct pleasure and honor to be able to tell you about our work among women veterans and the work we're doing to increase access to care to urinary incontinence. I'm just going to dive right in, but we're first going to touch on just some key factors related to the prevalence and treatment of urinary incontinence. We're going to review some of the first-line treatments, and I'm going to spend the rest of the talk really kind of deep dive into the research. But why this is important is that we've really been able to access care for urinary incontinence through a mobile health app called My Healthy Bladder. And then I'm going to talk to you about the evidence behind that and what we're doing. So let's just start. Again, I as a geriatrician, I can honestly say incontinence was one of the things that I saw in older women and men that I thought we've got to be doing better. I see and practice incontinence clinics at the VA, and I see men and women, but I do see them across the age ranges. So even though my training is in geriatrics, my scope of work is very broad in terms of treating this problem across the lifespan. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through today. But in general, one of the things I always say to the veterans and the patients I see, as well as trainees, is that urinary incontinence is never a normal part of aging. It is the involuntary loss of urine that really can have an effect on all things in terms of daily activities, and it can be very interfering. So I'm gonna talk more about this, but first let's just talk about how common it is. Urinary incontinence, this is a study, really, I like it graphically, but there's been data replicated in multiple other studies, including the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. But this is just sort of showing the prevalence of incontinence in women by severity. And so even though this was a study done outside of the U.S., it really does mirror what we see in the United States, is that it is extremely common and can reach up to 50% of women in older age ranges. And so the number I tend to use in terms of an average is around 30% of women experience this in the third, fourth, fifth decade, with slight bumps in the different types of incontinence, and then a bump around menopause. So a really important thing to consider. What are the risk factors? So I just talked about age, and of course, women are 2 times more likely to have incontinence than men. A lot of traditional risk factors that affect incontinence in, say, younger women are pregnancy, but may not be the case in older women. Not only just being pregnant, but your delivery, the mode of delivery, Those things have been associated with incontinence. And we do have wonderful evidence showing that actually weight loss can affect and improve incontinence. So that's why obesity is listed here, is because clinical trial evidence actually shows that it improves symptoms with weight loss. All the mechanisms related to that are not quite clear, but I do think it's important to state. Now, this diagram is something I tend to use in grant applications, and I borrowed this model from my sleep colleagues, but this is a 3P conceptual model. And why I think it's so relevant is that really there's some modifiable targets here. And so what we are trying to do in our research across this disorder is really look at these modifiable factors, and specifically what kind of things, toileting habits, knowledge about bladder function, knowledge about your own behaviors, fluid intake is really, even though I think both the predisposing, precipitating factors are highly relevant for the women veterans, especially the mental health conditions and overlays, as well as life events and stressors, really have a huge impact on pelvic floor, bladder function. And women veterans really do experience this. So we know the women veterans, increasing numbers across the country, women using the VA as a healthcare system, women veterans actually have more incontinence. And so it's pretty phenomenal to even look across women and men in the VA, women are much more likely to have incontinence than their male counterparts. And although we don't have all the evidence, there's been reports in the literature of factors that may increase rates among women veterans. It could be service-related factors, depending on the branch, type of service, where you served, access to toilets. I think this is a really understated reason that can affect incontinence, bladder function across the lifespan. So holding behaviors, not being able to go, holding too long, decreasing fluids because you know you're not going to be in a place where you can actually toilet. I would also say, in addition to other service-related factors, depending on the type of service, it could be not only access to toilets, but the types of job duties that you're doing. It can be very physically difficult. Physical strain and stress on the body definitely could have effect as well. And so I just can't stress this hard enough when dealing with incontinence. A lot of people, you know, incontinence may not be a highly morbid condition, but the impact on quality of life is enormous. Impact of incontinence, huge amount of distress when it comes to just symptom burden. I hear so many times from my veterans that they no longer do social activities because of leakage. They don't feel comfortable leaving or going places without good toilet access. The emotional impact, the financial impact on terms of how to manage this and self-management. And then data also shows it's a major reason why caregivers actually put loved ones with cognitive problems and other types of disorders into a nursing home, because the caregivers can no longer manage the bladder and bowel problems. So we also know there's sort of a gap between what we know, how common this is, and women just don't tend to, and this applies to women veterans too, why don't they get help? Well, they just feel like it's not bothersome enough. They're really in denial. It's going to get better. It's just normal aging. It's normal after having children. There's nothing that can be done for me. And I just don't feel comfortable telling my doctor. We'll touch on these a little bit more. But one of the things I really kind of stress when I talk to primary care and when I'm trying to go out and educate people about incontinence from a provider standpoint, provider to provider, is that I usually try to say, you know, even if you just add this to an intake form, you add it in just a conversation about, do you have anything you want to share in regards to your bladder problems? This is a standardized question that's been validated. During the last 3 months, have you leaked urine even a small amount? So this is part of 3 questions, but I would say of the 3, this would be a great one to use. And then before I dive into more of our evidence and projects, I just have to say that not all types of incontinence are always treated the same when you talk about second and third line treatments. But what I'm going to talk about today, first line treatments do treat all the three major types of incontinence. So the three types, it's really just two types, with many women having both urgency and stress incontinence. But urgency is that feeling like you have the urge and you can't get there in time. These women are that classic, I've got to go, I can't get there, I leak on the way. This is really common, becomes really more common than stress incontinence around the time of menopause and into later life. Stress incontinence, this is not emotional stress. This is actually physical stress on the bladder. Coughing, sneezing, bending, lifting, exercising. Stress, physical stress on the bladder, thought to be secondary to pelvic floor changes, laxity, whether that's weak muscles, injured muscles due to delivery, injured muscles due to other causes. But I will say what I'm going to talk to you today, behavioral treatments are good for all types of incontinence. And so we'll keep going from there. And I also would just say, behavioral treatments really are part of clinical practice guidelines, whether you're talking about clinical practice guidelines from the American Urologic Association, along with the Society of Urology and Urogynecology and Female Urology, the American Urogynecology Society. Many societies really have proven, and then evidence around this from systematic reviews done by funding agencies also suggests that we really should start with the least invasive treatments first, and that behavioral treatment should be offered first. Some people call behavioral treatment different names, but lifestyle, pelvic floor muscle exercises, all of that is actually part of behavioral treatment. And so here's just a schematic showing that this is just geared for urgency, but I would say it's this is an example of a schematic about urgency UI, overactive bladder, where you really want to start with lifestyle modifications as your first line treatments, including bladder training, behavioral urge suppression strategies, pelvic floor muscle exercises, also stress strategies if you have mixed incontinence, then go into drugs. And I'm not going to talk about these today, but both are available in the VA to prescribe. And then what to do when they no longer are getting better after all of these, you start talking about different treatments, including nerve stimulation, sacral nerve modulation, and even Botox in the bladder. So I'm going to really talk about these first line treatments and focus on those today. And then what this is just another schematic kind of showing what behavioral treatments as I conceive them to be. It is sort of a complete package where you're not only doing education on bladder, bladder function, and bladder health, you're talking about fluid management, other types of lifestyle, and you're really honing in on pelvic floors, how to use them under symptoms when you have urgency to help control that as well. So I've kind of touched on this, just to reiterate, is that about 30% of the women in the U.S., women veterans actually may have more commonly have urinary incontinence, but it's hard to really drill down on what those numbers are. I'll talk about this some more. But what we do know, there's a significant gap between what evidence-based care tells us to do and what the actual practice is. And one small study done across four different VA centers showed that even though women's health clinics and primary care clinics were actually assessing urinary incontinence treatments, less than 30% of those women had actually received behavioral treatments. So even though we may be doing a good job about asking, it's the delivery of care that may not be happening. And I think that's where a lot of what we're doing can really help. So that leads us to what is My Healthy Bladder? This is a mobile health app. We conceived this several years ago. I'll go into the history in a minute of how we developed and tested this. but it really is trying to deliver behavioral therapy to the women where they want it, when they want it. And we consider this a self-management program, is that this can be done outside of a clinical setting. And we have based this on, there are numerous clinical trials, all the evidence that goes into these evidence-based reviews on behavioral treatment have been combined and put into this as content, 8 weeks of content with daily less than 5 minute educational sessions, including motivation, motivational quotes, veteran stories, VA specific products that could be available, how to talk to your doctor. It is a very veteran centric product developed with veterans, for veterans, tested only among veterans. And then I'll show you some examples of that. We have embedded patient generated health data to assess urinary incontinence symptoms through this mobile health app. And then we actually piloted and found that it actually helped and people liked it. So I'll go through some of that as well as where we're going next with the project. But I know you can't read this. This is not meant to be read, but what it is kind of goes over the main categories of what we have. There's a lot of education in this. There's self-monitors and measures about symptom management, adherence to pelvic floor muscle exercise, how to use pelvic floor muscle exercise and toileting strategies, and what women like the most based on some of our work and qualitative analysis. They love the stories and inspirational quotes, the motivation, but it really does. These stories are about these topics. And so I'm just kind of going through on a broad scheme of what my healthy bladder is. We're currently using a VA contracted company called Tonic to deliver this. It's very much written at a sixth grade education level. It's meant to be digested in small bits, but that really is starts off first week one with pelvic floor muscle exercises, talks about anatomy and why this is important, self-monitoring, asking questions about how often you're actually using these strategies and exercises, and how to use those strategies and what they are. And it goes in step-by-step instructions. And here's just an example of a patient story. It goes into a few pages of this, but you can see we really tried to make the stories relevant to the content and make them relevant to the female veterans. Another key feature that we were able to add in after development of My Healthy Bladder were Annie text messages. So we realized a lot of the women kind of needed prompts, and unfortunately, our mobile health app doesn't automatically prompt them. So we partnered with the Annie group to do text message reminders just to help remind them and give them sample emails about the adherence. So we can monitor and see when women veterans aren't doing the sessions in real time or in a timely manner, and we can send out, push out these messages. So that is pretty much the first two objectives. I'm going to spend the rest of the talk doing a deeper dive into not only our funded projects, but the timeline and development. And I can honestly say that a lot of this work would not be feasible. And I've found more barriers to do this work outside of the VA versus within the VA as a healthcare system. And so I think it's really important just to mention the fact that the VA is a model learning health system. Being able to interact with key operational partners along the way has really made this a success. I would not be here without the group, the Women's Health Research Network, and including the our Women's Health Practice-Based Research Network. They've been a huge champion of these projects along the way. But just in terms of timeline, you can see it's almost been 10 years, but we were able to get project funding through the Office of Women's Health. And we did a needs assessment about how many facilities actually had pelvic floor physical therapists? What was the access to behavioral treatments? What kind of providers were there? And then they also gave us funding to do the formative work and actually work to with health educators, women veterans, to put the content together to start the mobile health app. So we did that, then we pilot tested it. And then through the pilot testing, we were awarded a HSR&D grant to actually study it across three sites. So a multi-site clinical trial, a type one hybrid clinical trial to test not only the effectiveness, but an implementation strategy. And then that was launched in 2020. I can tell you that we named this trial Practical, and it's probably the one trial or a few exceptions where we designed this to be fully trial, no in-person visits. We got our funding in January, COVID hit in March, and wow, I think COVID actually helped some of our recruitment. And then because we were doing this one, AHRQ announced a unique funding opportunity about how to increase access to care through primary care clinics. And so we applied, and that's the Pursuit study where AHRQ had funded our site to be part of a consortium, but we're unique. We're the only site funded to do the work in the VA. So I'm going to go through and talk about the evidence now for each of these, and I'll come back to this timeline. But this is just a quick snapshot of that pilot study. So this was a very small scale. We spent about 2 years actually developing the content, refining it, making it available on a platform, having a contract company. But then we tested it in 29 women veterans. You can see that not everyone actually completed it, but of those that completed it, all the sessions, or at least 80% was our landmark, our benchmark actually, that actually the urinary incontinence symptoms improved. So this is a validated urinary incontinence 3-question scoring questionnaire that they started kind of ranges 0 to 21. This is called the ICIQ, International Continence Urinary Incontinence Short Form, and it's used across several trials, including other trials in other countries using a mobile health app. So we picked this to be more in line with other current studies, and that we showed some clinical improvement over the 8 weeks and published our results. And this is what really matters to me, is at the end of the day, even though we might be improving symptoms, what are women saying? And so this was it took us a long time to put all this together, but this is from our pilot study among women veterans. And this was our qualitative analysis with one-to-one interviews. And you can see that women veterans really thought that this really helped in access. They didn't have to take off work. They thought the information was good, especially about the information they could get in the about VA and what the VA has to offer. They became more aware, and being more aware actually helped their overall well-being. You can see that they put it into perspective, that they felt less embarrassed to ask. They realized they weren't alone, and that strengthening the muscles help. And so these are just some key themes that came out of our analysis and what women veterans were saying. So hopefully that will be pop up in PubMed in the next day or two, but I've seen page proof, so this you can do a deeper dive if interested. And so that kind of gets us through our phase one and two. And then I want to talk about our funded HSR&D study and our results from that. So I'm jumping into our study called Practical. This study has been presented in a national meeting. It was well received, but I can tell you these results aren't published yet. What is published is our clinical trial design, and all of this is publicly available. But what I'm going to share with you today in terms of the outcomes, this is only published in abstract form. 3 sites. A huge thank you to other leaders on this project, Dr. Karen Goldstein, who led the way at the Durham site, Dr. Camille Vaughn, who partners with me in several studies on incontinence. She's located at the Emory University Atlanta VA, and that we used our three sites as our this multi-site clinical trial. And this is a unique adaptive design called a SMART design, where we not only randomized women to one of two treatments, but throughout the study, if women weren't getting better, we built in a second randomization. We called it an adaptive randomization, where we re-randomized women to receive a booster visit if they weren't improving in either arm. You can see that our randomization was to test my healthy bladder as compared to best usual care, which at the time, and again, this was during COVID, was a VA video connect visit with a continence specialist. And we standardized our specialist's approach and treatment on the video. We collected outcomes on the same platform over time. And we looked at outcomes in terms of what our primary outcome was. Even though it's an 8-week program, we chose a 12-week outcome. And we showed that we had 70% of the women stayed with us throughout the study. Key factor is the mean age is 53. This is spot on, really, to our overall women veteran demographic across the VA right now. And 56% self-identified as Black. And that's a little lower than the number of women we serve across our three sites, but is very consistent with where we are in the Southeast United States. And you can see more improvement was found in the women randomized to My Healthy Bladder as compared to the VA video connect or telehealth visits at 12 weeks. However, I will say that both groups really had significant improvement in their symptoms, and they both reached a clinically important difference in terms of the change in score at 12 weeks. However, among the women who really weren't getting better during the both groups, and they got re-randomized, we did not find that adding another video visit really made a difference in terms of improving symptoms at 12 weeks, and that we also looked at symptoms for durability at 6 months, 56 weeks. And even though there were no differences among My Healthy Bladder versus the VA video connect visits, that both groups remained improved and had significant improvements up to 6 months after using My Healthy Bladder, and also getting care through a continence specialist with remote care, which was sort of unique at this time. And so that's where we were able to apply, launch, complete a Tiber Type 1 clinical trial design for effectiveness. And then I'm going to jump into our most current study, which is HRQ funded, called Pursuit. And we really wanted to take the evidence and lessons that we've learned from the pilot, the clinical trial, and apply it more broadly. Because these trials, as good as they are, we really weren't getting the word out in a primary care setting that we had this available. We were just kind of testing it. Women were signing up. They weren't really talking to their primary care providers. And so this HRQ-funded project, which is part of their Evidence Now series about improving outcomes, QI projects in primary care settings, this was one of their big Evidence Now initiatives. Evidence Now initiatives have increased screening for cardiovascular disease, increased screening and treatment for alcohol use disorders. And so this was, incontinence was part of one of their big efforts. And I'm just so thankful to have had the opportunity to work across this consortium. But you can see in the lower right-hand corner of the slide, there were other sites in Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, and California. Even though we were across our entire VISN, it's not represented on this one slide in the bottom right, but really we conceived this project to be VISN-wide. Our VISN, VISN 7, is Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. Our goal was to recruit at least 60 primary care practices with the goal of having 50 in the end, both at the VA Medical Centers and Community-Based Outpatient Clinics, or CBOCs. And we did not restrict the women on many things for eligibility, is that they just had to have incontinence for at least 3 months, receive primary care, and have access to be able to use the mobile health app. So what we attempted to do as we enrolled sites, we used a practice facilitation as our main practice-based intervention. For women veterans, My Healthy Bladder was our main focus. But what we did is we did rolled it out over 6 months, where we did virtual and or, if needed, on-site visits to educate primary care CBOT practices about My Healthy Bladder, but more importantly about incontinence, about asking about it, about the resources that we had. We have all kinds of provider resources, a toolkit, and I'll show you that, what really is, and we have a very unique clinical dashboard for providers. And our goal was to have these clinics know about the project. If women asked about it, they could refer, or women could also self-refer. So with primary care providers' approval, we were able to send out letters to their practices, basically endorsing this. If they have the problem, they could contact us directly. So direct outreach with provider approval. I'll show you in a minute, but our letters actually had QR codes which women could scan and get directly to our team. And if they didn't want to do My Healthy Bladder and just wanted to see us, we had consult pathways as well built into the study. So this is our tools. We have a whole SharePoint for providers. We made sure people knew how to use it, access it as part of our practice facilitation. We helped them learn about our SharePoint site, where we gave them several clinical posters to hang in clinics, flyers, all kinds of stuff. But if they needed to print out any more, after, if they couldn't get a hold of us, all of that lives on our SharePoint site. But this is a really novel piece of this, is that we also, on our SharePoint site, have a data dashboard. A huge thanks to Dr. Zach Burningham at the Salt Lake City VA, who was able to help us pull real-time data from CDW into this dashboard. It drills down to not only the clinic site, but you can actually drill down to an individual provider and see the number of women veterans, when the big part, the rows and columns in the middle, is your specific patient panel. This is a de-identified version, of course, for the talk today, but it drills down to not only who's coming in and when, but have they already had a diagnosis in the medical record, and how many risk factors do they have? And we picked out some risk factors that could be used with the data dashboard, with the data at hand, including BMI, age, of course, deliveries, if they had prior hysterectomies, and then frailty. And again, we also link this with their overall panel CAN score. You can click on individual patients to look at individual risk. You can see what your current diagnosis rate, and then the number of diagnoses and the number of diagnoses by risk factor. So just a really unique tool. And so I am going to jump into some of the data that we are currently gathering and tell you a little bit more about the study called Pursuit. Here is a graphic showing all of the sites involved. You can see that we did a reach out, not only to our main centers, but across our entire states. We did not go across South Carolina. There were some time and money constraints there, but we're super excited about our South Carolina partners in this. But you can see we did reach 60 clinics total, 16 were rural. The numbers of women that they serve, based on the data we could get, are listed here. You can see Georgia, one of the bigger states, as well as South Carolina. In South Carolina, it's really only 4 clinics associated with both Columbia and Charleston. And so the numbers probably are even larger across the entire state, but we focused our efforts on some of the highest clinics that serve the most women veterans in South Carolina. We did the practice facilitation with baseline 3-month and 6-month visits. I can say most of those visits were done, and we're still collecting outcomes, 6-month outcomes in South Carolina. We're done with 1-to-1, whether it's teams, phone, or just in person with a practice facilitator. And then some were done by email just to make things best on busy clinical practices. We did not have any clinics withdraw from the study. You can see this was one of our main practice related outcomes, and this comes from the data dashboard, is that we wanted to see, by doing this project in a 6-month period, could we change the rates of diagnosis of urinary incontinence and other lower urinary tract symptoms in a primary care panel setting across all these 3 states. It was 19% overall, so I think this is low, although I'm encouraged that it's not lower than what's actually been reported according to diagnosis codes in the literature in the VA setting. But across our sites, we think this should be a little higher. Probably a goal would be 30%. But you can see Alabama, Georgia having the lowest baseline, and then South Carolina are all kind of on par. And I can say, even though I'm not going to share the data today, that we've significantly increased diagnosis rates through this project from baseline to 6 months by 3% or more. And it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, that's not, may sound like a small number, but the huge number of women veterans that actually represents is pretty impressive. And I can also say we've had a huge influx of women veterans using the VA and establishing healthcare, and we're capturing data on the huge influx of women veterans across these clinics. And despite the number increasing numbers of women in each in all of these clinics, we're still seeing an increase in diagnosis rates. So just good news. I'm going to talk a little bit about recruitment, because I think without our recruitment strategies, we would never have been able to touch as many clinics and women veterans. And I can't thank my team enough for all the wonderful work they did to put these materials together. Again, they were all IRB approved, even though this is really more of a QI project of increasing access to care on a novel platform. But here's a picture on the right of our main flyer that we send to women veterans, along with the letter. So we found that actually the clinic flyer has been useful, but the letter, direct mailing, has been the most effective way for us to recruit women into this study. Women contact us through this QR code. It goes directly to our team, kind of takes it out of primary care. But again, if primary care wants to, they can just endorse the project. If they want to, they can send us a referral, and we'll enroll them. So we have different avenues to engage primary care providers and primary care clinicians. And so you can see here, these are basically our main recruitment. And then we also found, I would say, the letters were the most effective, even though we had a significant amount of clinical referrals. But I also, we partnered with our My Healthy Vet groups, at least in Alabama and Georgia. We weren't able to do this in South Carolina, but we have partnered and were able to send out messages directly to women who have engaged with My Healthy Vet to let them know about this project as well. So with our recruitment efforts, I cannot say enough about the fabulous team that we have, who have sent out almost 38,000 letters. You can see where we sent to Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. We've sent over 20,000 emails. That's usually, when I say emails, through My Healthy Vet. We've had about a 9% response rate. So of the women who got a letter and or went to the clinic, and basically mostly through the QR code, almost 3,500 women have been screened. about 3,200 women. We've had a huge pouring. About 92% of those screened are actually enrolled. And I'm not going to share the symptom improvement data, but we're tracking it, and symptoms are improving among the women who do My Healthy Bladder. We have noticed, though, that some of the dropouts and engagement, it says lower than expected. It's actually a little higher than expected. You know, I think it's hard sometimes for women veterans to stick with the program, but we're looking at both baseline 4-week, 8-week outcomes. And so we really do see improvements across these time points, and we're monitoring and dropouts and engagement with the actual My Healthy Bladder very closely. We do send out some reminders, but women have to opt in to get those through Annie. So it's not perfect in terms of a mobile health platform and the system that we're looking for, but we're really happy to have the response that we do. We did a small pilot project really showing that we did about a 10% sample and did a chart review that really about only a third of the women that we had enrolled had actually discussed it, or it was brought up in a visit in terms of a text review of the CPRS medical record. So that's pretty spot on, and we hope to change that, but that's about what we expected going into this. So just a little bit in terms of a few more summary slides. I think this has actually been sort of a paradigm shift in the last 5 years in care for incontinence, is that you really don't have to come in and see a specialist. In fact, you don't have to come in and see a specialist at all, but you can actually do this via telehealth. And this is also written into the most recent guidelines that telehealth isn't a viable option. I think we have shown through some of the data presented today that we've actually been able to impact and improve access to care for women who haven't even talked to their primary care physicians, even among rural women. It actually, having an app like this does increase access to effective treatments. So we're showing some efficacy as well. And we're trying to bridge the gap between that provider and veteran awareness, so that we know that if providers screen or ask about incontinence, they know there's a treatment that they can give, at least to get women started. So I will jump into some of our next steps, because I've really been fortunate to have a lot of key operational partners. And most recently, we've been working with key operational partners in the Office of Connected Care. A big thank you to Lisa Wong and the Office of Health Innovations. We are currently shifting and adapting. As anyone knows who works in this space, that you have a lifespan on technology. Technology is always changing, but we're really excited. We just got a contract approved and some money to adapt this project onto a actual VA-approved platform. So this is a VA-approved platform that works really well in terms of integrating into the VA system already. Would not have been possible to make these connections without these key operational partners. We are just now starting the adaption process of taking the content, making some minor tweaks and changes based on our current work. And we hope to really be able to pilot test it. Global Telehealth Services has a current mobile health app for spinal cord injury with patient monitoring that integrates into CPRS. I think this would be a landmark ability in any mobile health app in the VA system. Our goal is to get this somewhere, increased knowledge and awareness, and maybe hopefully get this on one of the VA approved mobile apps that are on the Office of Connected Care's website. We'd love to spread and scale this to women outside of Vision 7. And so that's why I'm really excited to tell you about this today. And in conclusion, we know that many women veterans want treatment, even if it's outside our provider visits. We feel like remote delivery of behavioral treatments is effective based in many years of evidence and clinical trial work and guidelines, but without engaging providers, I don't think this would be as successful. I'm looking at data to show that it actually does matter to engage providers, of course, especially many of you on this call, women's health providers, making women veterans and their care providers aware of this. And I do think at the end of the day, having the VA endorse this project, have it really be more prominent, really legitimizes it as a treatment and will improve access. So I'll stop there. I would love to see if there's any questions on any part of this. I unfortunately don't have a slide to recognize the many people who have worked with us on here, and that is a fault of my own. I will say I would not have been able to present this today without my two main mentors in the VA, Dr. Patty Goode, who had recently passed away, and then Dr. Kathy Bergier, who I remain in close contact with. So without their help and guidance throughout my career, wouldn't be here today, as well as my team. And other collaborators, co-investigators, just a tremendous amount of effort and work has gone into this over the years. So thank you.
Thank you so much for an excellent presentation, Dr. Markland. I think let's turn it over to Dr. Chelsea Morgan, who's our discussant today, for her her contribution and discussion of what you have presented today.
Yes, thank you, and outstanding work, Dr. Markland. I feel like this was really inspirational just to see where we can go with technology. I love just some of those pearls, things that primary care providers like myself, I still keep a clinic, and those are some questions that I can easily slide in asking about, you know, what happened in the last 3 months? Have you had any leaking? And we also know that you had some really good outcomes with that sustained improvement. So, you know, I'm just excited to see where we can do with that. When we think about our women veterans, a lot of our women veterans, we're still caregivers. We're caregivers to spouses, to parents, to children. So having a virtual option, having something that also you don't have to go to your provider for by kind of creating that self-referral, is really removing that barrier. So I think that's one reason why you probably got such a great response. And when I'm thinking about the age of our women veterans, most of our women veterans are 34 to 64. So that postpartum range, a lot of people are experiencing some pelvic floor dysfunction, some urinary incontinence, and you know, our maternity care coordinators could easily connect people to these sorts of resources, maybe without having to go back to see their primary care provider, because we're expanding that maternity care to a whole 12 months after delivery. So that's just such a great opportunity right there to, once again, like you said, just use that virtual connection and plug people in. But what that also means is that we have a lot of women who are coming our way that are going to be in that geriatrics population soon. So we're going to see a huge explosion in that age range. So I'm really excited to see what we will build by the time people are of that age range and we're having more and more urinary incontinence and pelvic floor dysfunction. So far, we have been able to kind of track, like you said, what's happening with our pelvic floor physical therapy. We're having more and more people need those services. In FY23, at least 28,000 encounters in pelvic floor physical therapy across the country. So that's huge. And 18,000 of those were specifically coded for urinary incontinence, which, as you mentioned, like this is kind of a compound issue. So it doesn't have to only be urinary incontinence. So there's so many more people that we're not even catching. When you said that about a third of people hadn't even spoken to their provider, and you know, speaking as a PCP, a lot of people have to go through a lot to get to the appointment with me, and then they have so many things on their list, or they might be embarrassed. So 2/3 of people were connected to you, and they, you know, they had spoken to their provider, or they had not spoken to their provider about it. So that just tells us there's more and more people that we really just need to direct to consumer market some of these things, for lack of other words. And I want to speak quickly so we have some time for questions for the audience, but one question I had for you, with the mean age being 53, how did you find the mobile platform was received by that older or in some cases geriatric women veteran population, and any tips or lessons learned with trying to customize technology to that age group?
Hi, thank you, Dr. Morgan. Thank you for all those important points. I do, as a geriatrician, I feel like I don't want to leave anyone out based on any kind of age alone. But our older veterans and our older women veterans, as we know, tend to be multiple chronic conditions, a little frail. We allowed any woman veteran who, if they wanted to enroll and had a caregiver who could help them, whether that be a grandchild or someone else, we were like, sure, you know, please, if you want to have a care partner in your help, and it actually worked. I'm going to look in a deeper dive into the data among the older veterans. I will say there were a few older women who didn't feel comfortable using a mobile phone, or didn't really have a good grasp of a computer. And unfortunately, because of this technology, that's a limitation. But we were also thoughtful about the platform we chose is really web-based. It's not mobile phone-based. And so if older women don't feel comfortable using a smartphone or a mobile phone, they can engage with this on an actual computer platform. But if you don't have either one of those two, it would be difficult unless you had a good care provider that could help you with this. So again, incontinence is sort of a private thing, but I will say there's been a lot of mother-daughter dyads who have helped engage with us. I will say here in Alabama, there are actual access to internet connectivity issues that are real and have also kept some people from engaging with us. So it's not just the older adults, but people in very rural areas, even though, you know, we would love to be able to provide them with the tools they need, there's some limitations there. But your point's really well taken. We've tried to not exclude our older, less technology driven populations at all. And I'd love to do a deeper dive into those. And we're trying to do some qualitative work on the older veterans that participated with us to see if there's any kind of themes in that group that we can take lessons learned and apply to different avenues.
Yeah, thank you. I know accessibility is so important, but also just partnering with people in the home. So I love that solution, inviting people to bring their care partners into their treatment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Jessica to see if she has any questions. So Dr. Friedman.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you both for a great discussion. I'll lead off with a clinical question that's really directed to both you, Dr. Morgan, and you, Dr. Markland. In the clinical setting, what do you see as the biggest barrier to women bringing up UI during their visit with their provider?
Yeah, great question. I really will say it can be on both parts. So I would never say it's just the provider. It also can be the veteran themselves where, you know, like Dr. Morgan mentioned, there's a long list of other problems that kind of get pushed to the forefront. And that we all know we have limited time. It's hard to address everything in a primary care setting. And so I think there's just some barriers on the provider side. You know, just maybe it could be that they don't feel comfortable asking about it, but I think more importantly, if they ask about it, then what do they do about it? You know, is there an easy way to send a referral? Is it more complicated? Are there barriers to actually getting care? If you ask about it, then how do you get the care to treat it? And again, it's not that primary care providers can't do some of these treatments, but they are time consuming. They're really time consuming, and it's nice to be able to send to a therapist or a clinic that focuses on this. I think from a women veterans perspective, I think some of the reasons I listed there is a lot of women just think it's normal. There's nothing to be done about it, and they don't want to talk about it, or they may not feel comfortable talking about it. But I'll let Dr. Morgan really answer this from her perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I think embarrassment is probably a big part of what comes up. And it's just like a lot of questions that you ask people that can be kind of touchy, trying to frame it as, this is very common. Does this ever happen to you? Or, oh, you know, a lot of my veterans say they have X, Y, or Z. Does this ever happen in your daily life? So normalizing it is something that helps. And even then they're kind of blushing, but then it does come out.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. We have a couple questions in the Q&A that I think are very similar, so I'm going to lump them together. Can anyone use the My Healthy Bladder link? Is there a link that we can provide to patients? And one person who entered this into the Q&A indicated they have rural patients in the Western U.S. who might be very interested.
I think this is where I really, really, really hope to go. We're just not there yet. I will say, our current platform, Tonic, has decided they don't want to maintain the contract, but we've secured another contract and we'll be moving all of this onto a VA-approved mobile health application group. We're super excited about this. Right now, it's really restricted to Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina veterans. But with this adaptation, we have a very tight timeline. We hope to actually be able to open this up soon. I really hate to say we have such a great project that and program, but our next steps are really to try to open this up more broadly. I think there's a need, and I appreciate these questions. I just think we're probably 6 months to a year to getting to that. I would want to adapt it, do some pilot testing, make sure veterans like it, make sure they're actually it's easy to use, but we are on track to do this. I'm really excited.
That's great. I have another question for you, Dr. Markland. Were there any surprises in terms of veteran feedback from the pilot testing of My Healthy Bladder app?
Yeah, we actually learned a lot from the pilot to the clinical trial. So we've actually adapted it several times. So we've adapted My Healthy Bladder 3 times over this time period. What we heard is more women veterans want to have access to the sessions after they complete them. So they really wanted the content. So we've made a companion booklet. We also learned in this may go to the earlier question about older veterans. Some people want to see a written summary of this. So we made a companion booklet that women veterans can use, and that is very clinically useful. It has the same pictures, a lot of the same content in a condensed version, but this all the same treatments. We also found that women veterans really kind of wanted more videos, a little bit more pictures, you know, like a little less word heavy. Now, by no means can I say that we got funding to make this a all video, high quality. We link videos to our program, but we haven't gone the distance of creating our own video content for this. It's extremely costly to do it professionally. It's extremely costly to do it and time consuming to make it behind the VA and within VA. There's some barriers. I'd love to do more with this. I'd love to partner with others. I mean, I think there's way more that we could do here. But right now we're kind of just making it accessible, showing that it works. And then I think we can continue. And I really hope to make some even bigger improvements with this next iteration on the new platform. So I'm also, what I haven't heard, and I was surprised, so one of the things I thought I'd hear and didn't hear, that it's too long, it's too repetitive. haven't heard that, but I do know a lot of women veterans don't get to the full 8 weeks.
That's great. Wrap up with this final question. What would be the best approach for dissemination across other sites?
Hey, we're working on that. So we'd love to be able to partner as we do this rollout and kind of see what parts of our provider toolkit are really useful. We have a sense of maybe what works in the Southeast, but we'd love to be able to partner with other people at other sites. We're in the phase of looking for partners, so please don't hesitate to contact our team. You can contact me directly. I'm just ElaineMarklin@va.gov. We really do want to think about scalability. I don't want this just to be a project that kind of dies on the vine. I think it has great clinical applicability, outside of the Southeast United States. So I'd love to partner with others.
Great. Thank you both so much. So we are at the top of the hour. A few closing remarks. Thank you again all for attending the Spotlight on Women's Health Cyber Seminar. For those of you who may not be familiar, we do support this WERP toolkit, which helps if you're looking to recruit or analyze data about women veterans in your studies. I'd encourage you to access this link. It is only available internally within the VA network. And then finally, if you're curious to learn more about the Women's Health Research Network, please enter your information in our survey so you can get information about upcoming cyber seminars, trainings. We do lots of different things. So please go ahead and reach out to us. We'd love to engage folks in the audience more. So with that, I'd like to thank both Dr. Marklin and Dr. Morgan for your participation today and talking about this really meaningful and important topic for women veterans' health. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt attendees. When we close momentarily, a short survey will pop up. Please take a few moments and provide answers to those questions.